Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
Listening to KMXT 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. At present, it is 42 degrees Fahrenheit and overcast here in Kodiak. For today, rain likely, cloudy with a high near 47, an east wind around 15 miles per hour with gusts as high as 25 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 60%. For tonight, rain mainly before 4 a.m., a low around 40, an east wind of 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts as high as 30 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 80%. For Tuesday, rain likely, mainly after 10 a.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 45, an east wind around 10 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 60%. For Tuesday night, rain likely, mostly cloudy with a low around 40, an east wind around 15 miles per hour with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 70%. For Wednesday, rain with a high near 45, an east wind of 15 to 25 miles per hour.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. This week, jurors will begin deliberating whether a former Minneapolis police officer should be convicted of killing George Floyd last May. They will do so while sequestered at a downtown hotel under the protection of the National Guard. In his closing argument today, Prosecutor Stephen Schleicher said Chauvin, not Floyd's health, was responsible.
This wasn't a sudden cardiac arrhythmia, right? Dr. Smock told you that. Dr. Thomas, Dr. Rich, Dr. Tobin, they agree. Not a sudden cardiac arrhythmia. That's not how this looks.
But the defense says Derek Chauvin followed his police training. NPR's David Shaper says the Minneapolis area is bracing for possible unrest when there's a verdict.
Crews spent the weekend adding concrete barriers, high fencing, and razor wire outside of downtown courthouses and other high-profile government buildings, while desert sand-colored Humvees and heavily armed National Guard soldiers are stationed on just about every corner in downtown Minneapolis and at other locations throughout the region. Some area residents say while the military presence is eerie, the security measures do make them feel safer, after more than 1,000 buildings were damaged or destroyed in the rioting that followed George Floyd's death last summer. But others find it all disconcerting and say it deepens the divide between police and the community. David Shaper, NPR News, Minneapolis.
Federal regulators are now asking a struggling third-party manufacturer to temporarily halt production of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccines. Here's NPR's Sydney Lupkin.
The Food and Drug Administration asked Emergent BioSolution to stop manufacturing Johnson & Johnson's main vaccine ingredient until its regulators can complete their inspection. That's according to a financial filing Emergent made with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Emergent contaminated a batch earlier this year, but the third-party manufacturer has not yet received the FDA's blessing to officially join Johnson & Johnson's supply chain, so its products have not yet made it to the American public. Until that happens, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine supply will be low. Rare blood clots also pushed regulators to recommend halting administration of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine while they investigate. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Scientists around the globe are celebrating a 21st century Wright Brothers moment. NASA's experimental helicopter Ingenuity briefly rose into the air above Mars today, a first on another planet, as we hear in this recording of the helicopter's chief pilot back on Earth, Haver Grip.
Altimeter data confirms that Ingenuity has performed its first flight, the first flight of a powered aircraft on another planet.
A historic 39 seconds, Ingenuity's flight lasting 27 seconds longer than the first successful flight of Orville and Wilbur Wright's Flyer back in 1903. The Dow is down 121 points. This is NPR News.
Alaska will offer tourists vaccinations starting on June 1st as part of a plan, as part of the state's plan to assist tourism-related businesses. Governor Mike Dunleavy made the announcement today at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage. The plan also includes a national advertising company, as well as aid based on what businesses tell state leaders they need.
State officials acknowledge that the U.S.'s relatively high vaccination rate compared with other countries could make Alaska's offer attractive internationally. State Public Health Director Heidi Hedberg says the state currently has plenty of vaccines.
We are not setting aside or delineating vaccine for Alaskans or non-residents. Right now, what we're saying is today is the day, Alaskans. Please get educated. Please get vaccinated. And starting June 1st, it's going to be opened up for those tourists.
She says the state is planning to offer sites in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Ketchikan. The plan is for the vaccinations to happen outside of the security areas at the airports, so state residents can get a vaccine when they pick up visitors. Dunleavy is also proposing to spend $150 million to promote tourism and adapt for the potential loss of the cruise ship season. The state tourism money would come from the $1 billion Alaska can determine how to spend from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. Dunleavy says the national advertising campaign would likely be one of the largest the state has ever funded.
It's going to be print, it'll be digital, it'll be on TV stations, radio stations. We want to make sure that they don't forget about Alaska. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of beautiful states down lower 48. This is a spectacular state.
In describing who could benefit from the tourism assistance, Dunleavy notes that both large and small businesses have been affected. One small business owner is artist Robert McCoy Apangaluk of Gamble. He carves walrus ivory, whalebone, baleen, and antlers. He usually sells to tourists, but that income vanished during the pandemic, which started shortly after his daughter was born. At one point, he received an eviction notice.
I had never felt like such a failure, and certain I had made the wrong decision choosing my art as a career. Fortunately, I found a new to me market via social media and a rebirth in support that has allowed me to regain my confidence as an artist.
He calls for compromises to help tourism businesses for the future. Regarding Dunleavy's plan, the governor says the state could provide holidays from paying certain licenses and fees to help support tourism. But he also says details of how the money will be spent will draw from what Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer hears on a two-week tour meeting with tourism-related businesses and community leaders. Meyer acknowledges that Southeast communities were hit particularly hard by the loss of cruise ship visits.
It's hard to make up that difference with independent travelers, but again, with a robust marketing program, we're going to get as many up here as we can.
Meyer plans to visit Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Kenai, Homer, Fairbanks, Healy, and Nome. Dunleavy also laid out his plan for the entire amount the state will receive from the American Rescue Plan Act. It includes $150 million for tourism, $325 million for relief for businesses and other organizations, and another $325 million for infrastructure investments, including in safe water, sewers, and broadband. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
President Biden wants to pass a huge infrastructure bill, and at least two members of Alaska's congressional delegation are inclined to help. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin has the story.
Congressman Don Young and Senator Lisa Murkowski say infrastructure spending benefits Alaska. Young says the scope of Biden's $2 trillion proposal is too wide, but he agrees the U.S. needs to go big.
I've said we need at least $1 trillion for highways, bridges, airports, and ports, and the whole bit. It's the service trend. We need that because we're so far behind.
Young met with President Biden at the White House a few days ago and also took a meeting with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg.
I'm working with the secretary, and we're going to try to figure we can come out with a compromise. Whether it will work or not, I don't know. Even on my side, some people don't want to do anything. But I argue that this country, to survive, has to have a better economic basis of transportation. And it's not just jobs. This is for the future.
Like Young, Murkowski says the infrastructure bill should stick to more traditional definitions of infrastructure rather than the billions Biden wants to spend on caregiver jobs. When she talks to cabinet members about infrastructure, Murkowski says she talks about saving Alaska's ferry system.
I told there anybody who will listen that when it comes to infrastructure, you have to remember that it's not just infrastructure on land, it's also infrastructure on water. So it's your ports, it's your harbors, but also for many parts of our state, the highway is our waterway.
She's floating the idea of electric-powered ferries for the smaller vessels of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Since the Biden administration is so keen on electric vehicles, Murkowski says, the idea should appeal.
If the administration is going to go this way, if they're going to make this push, I want to make sure that we're going to see some of that benefit, too.
Senator Dan Sullivan did not grant several interview requests to discuss infrastructure, but he did appear at a Republican news conference where several senators outlined what they'd like to see in an infrastructure bill. Sullivan had one thing on his list.
It's permitting reform.
Sullivan wants to speed up the environmental review process. That will be a tough sell with this administration. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland just rescinded Trump administration orders to streamline permitting. Haaland says they were inconsistent with her department's commitment to protect public health and conserve land, water, and wildlife. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The 4th Judicial District has caught up to Alaska after an order issued Friday will stay eviction proceedings in the courts. As KUAC's Robin reports, all courts in Alaska are observing the CDC's moratorium on evictions during the pandemic.
The moratorium on evictions was first issued by the Centers for Disease Control on September 4th to prevent folks from losing their rental homes during the pandemic. The federal order says that landlords cannot evict tenants who can't pay their rent because they got sick with COVID-19 or lost their jobs in the pandemic economy. But it is not a magic pass. Tenants must show they've tried everything to come up with the money, must fill out a CDC declaration form, and must communicate with their landlord about their compliance with the CDC's rules. It was originally meant to expire December 31st, but was extended to January 31st, then March 31st, and now June 30th. In each of the 4 judicial districts in Alaska, the presiding judge has issued an order to the courts to follow the moratorium. In the 4th judicial district, which covers Fairbanks and Bethel, presiding judge Terrence Haas just updated the order on Friday.
I'm issuing an order for the 4th judicial district that's going to match the order from the other judicial districts.
Before that, the presiding judges in the other 3 districts had issued their administrative orders April 1st to observe the moratorium. Some Fairbanks attorneys were frustrated that there was no PJ order from the presiding judge after the last one expired March 31st, and some eviction proceedings got on the April court calendar here. Haas said that should not happen.
The law is the law. The presiding judge's order doesn't create the law as far as the CDC is concerned. It's just meant to create some administrative provisions to help implement it. But in any court in Alaska, it's going to be covered by the CDC provisions related to eviction and the moratorium.
Some tenants facing evictions have applied to rental relief programs set up after coronavirus relief legislation. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation processed 8,000 applications last summer for renters and homeowners. After the second relief bill was passed in December, AHFC was assigned $200 million to pass through to renters only. Stacy Barnes, AHFC's public affairs director, says the application deadline for the second program was in the first week of March.
So as of March 5th, at that deadline, we received more than 30,000 applications from Alaskans for rent relief. We are going through this process as quickly as we can. As of this date, we've actually approved 6,100 of them for payment.
Barnes says the payments go directly to the landlords and should prevent them from filing a court action to evict their tenants.
Well, on the other hand, if you are a person who has been struggling to make ends meet, frankly, we'll never be able to get this payment to you fast enough.
Barnes says a third housing relief program may open this summer that could provide more financial stability for landlords. Some evictions that have been stayed during the pandemic may eventually end up in court when the moratorium on evictions is lifted. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Most of the members of Alaska's citizen board that regulates and sets rules for fishing in state waters are up for confirmation by the state legislature this year. As KSDK's Sage Smiley reports, some of the governor's nominees to the Board of Fisheries are drawing scrutiny.
The Board of Fish has a lot of power over one of Alaska's cornerstone resources, so the composition of the seven-member body and how it balances interests can cause quite a hullabaloo. One ongoing point of contention is geography.
Currently, the board has only one coastal member, John Jensen from Petersburg.
That's House Speaker Louise Stutes, a Kodiak Republican, speaking at a joint committee meeting last weekend.
The other six members are from Anchorage, Willow, Eagle, and Fairbanks. The balance is not acceptable to any community that relies on commercial fishing, one of Alaska's greatest industries.
It's not just where they live. It's also how they allocate fish between the often competing interests of commercial, subsistence, and sport users. Recently, a commercial fishing industry group has organized opposition to current chairwoman Marit Carlson-Van Dort. Speaking to lawmakers, Carlson-Van Dort defended her record, saying she listens to all sides.
I have done all that I know to do to make sure that I have been honest and transparent with the public. Everybody knows that the Board of Fisheries process is a very public and very involved process.
United Fishermen of Alaska, an industry group that represents harvesters and processors, called on the commercial fleet to oppose her.
She said earlier today that she's worked hard to broker compromise. I did not see that whatsoever. In fact, it seemed like the opposite of that.
One of those was Kodiak fisherman Danielle Ringer. She recalled feeling like Carlson-Van Dort came to a recent Board of Fish meeting with her mind made up already.
But it felt like our words were actually lost on her, and she appeared sort of bizarrely wholly uninterested in what people were sharing.
But others spoke more favorably. Rachel Allen is from the Alaska Peninsula community of Chignik, where Carlson-Van Dort has fished. She says Carlson-Van Dort puts the health of the fishery first.
If Marit has any bias, it's a bias to protect salmon, and I really highly support her, and I hope you will take her.
MatSU Republican Representative Kevin McCabe asked Carlson-Van Dort whether she would rethink any of her positions in the face of opposition from commercial fishing groups.
Would you stand by it? Would you take the same vote today if it was knowing that the opposition you were going to get from the Kodiak fishermen and UFA and everybody, it seems like, on the planet, would you still take the same vote to protect the fish?
Through the chair, yes, I would.
Five nominees were under scrutiny during a marathon six-hour weekend meeting of the Alaska House Resources and Fisheries Committees. Public testimony was limited to 60 people. Two of Governor Mike Dunleavy's nominees have worked for the Pebble Partnership, which seeks a massive open-pit mine at the headwaters of Bristol Bay. Carlson-Van Dort is one of them. Timothy Gervais of the tiny Yukon town of Ruby called out the other.
I regard Abe Williams as a shill and a promoter for the Pebble Partnership.
He's referring to Anchorage-based Williams' day job as a director of regional affairs for the Pebble Limited Partnership. Williams has defended his stance, pointing out that he's from the Bristol Bay region.
I engage with communities that have been closely related to the project. I also have engaged with fishermen over the years and continue to do so right now. On top of that, I fished in Bristol Bay and have for 39 years and continue to do so alongside three of my boys, and will continue to do so until my hair is too gray or I can't handle it anymore.
Appointed last year when the COVID-19 pandemic shortened the legislative session, Williams has yet to be confirmed by lawmakers. Mackenzie Mitchell, an adjunct at the University of Alaska Fairbanks who has worked as a seasonal guide, is in the same boat. MatSU attorney and former Dunleavy legislative aide John Wood is up for reconsideration this year after having only served since 2019. That's because he joined the board to fill a term after the legislature rejected nominee Carl Johnstone, a former state judge accused of inappropriate behavior while on the board. The only nominee that received no critical comments is a longtime member and former chair of the board. Petersburg's John Jensen is up for another three-year term and will be the Board of Fish's only sitting member from a coastal community. Confirmation of all five nominees remains to be considered by a full floor of the House and Senate. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
In many rural Alaska communities, the high cost of construction can lead to housing shortages, unsafe living conditions, and overcrowding. A new mini-home project is working to tackle the problem in the remote southeast Alaska town of Yakutat. As KCAW's Aaron McKinstry reports, the Sitka-based construction company behind the project hopes its idea spreads.
In a large gravel lot, a handful of workers ferry buckets of drywall mud between four tightly spaced homes. They're building these 450-square-foot structures assembly line style.
Like right now, we're in sheetrocking mode, and so we got all the sheetrocking tools, and we jump from this one, get this one sheetrocked, and go on to the next one.
Derek James is co-owner of Sitka Construction Solutions, the company behind the project. James calls these mini homes. They're bigger than a tiny house and smaller than a conventional one, but built to the same standards. There's a bedroom, small bathroom, and basic kitchen. They also call them modular homes because they're built in one location and later finished somewhere else on a permanent foundation. All four are destined for Yakutat, a place that James says is desperately in need of housing.
Every house in Yakutat is full, whether it's habitable or not. I mean, unless the walls and roof are falling down, there's probably somebody in it.
James and his business partner, Chris Karsunke, understand the problem intimately. They grew up together in Yakutat. Karsunke says new construction in Yakutat is rare, partly because it's so expensive.
The price per square foot to build in a rural community is pretty outrageous. You can figure about a third more than Sitka itself.
That's because it's not just building materials that have to be shipped in. It's labor. Many rural communities lack licensed professionals, like electricians and plumbers, and paying them to get there comes at a cost. So Karsunke and James thought, why not build in Sitka, where their equipment and their labor pool is, and then ship them to Yakutat on a barge or ferry?
We might as well get 95% of the work done here and pay the local rate, and they can go home to their families every night and save money for the customer.
They started small by building one for Karsunke's mom, who wanted to downsize from a larger house. The Sitka-built mini home turned heads from the day it arrived.
We didn't even get it parked on the lot and start to set it up on a foundation. And people were stopping by and asking questions.
The concept attracted the attention of the Yakutat Tlingit tribe, which ordered four mini homes to serve as temporary shelter for crime victims. And these latest four are a joint project between the tribe and the Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority to provide homes for elders near the Yakutat Senior Center. It's one of 10 projects in Southeast Alaska awarded funding from the CARES Act to address housing needs during the pandemic. Housing Authority Executive Director Jackie Peta says other tribes are building duplexes or expanding existing homes. All of the projects are aimed at addressing overcrowding, which became a serious concern during the pandemic. The virus can spread more quickly in tight living quarters.
We know in Southeast Alaska and most of our communities, many families are overcrowded, multi-generational families living in one home. And so any housing that we can produce in Southeast Alaska is going to relieve overcrowding.
James and Karsunke don't believe that the mini home concept is limited to Yakutat. They've had interest from people in Sitka and surrounding communities who see it as a way to add high quality, affordable housing. Including appliances and shipping, each one costs around $125,000. They're able to keep prices low by buying and shipping supplies in bulk from Seattle.
We can put an order in for the lumber package for multiple at one time and get shipping containers up here with, you know, windows, doors, insulation, all of it into one big shipping container.
Still, they face hurdles to building them on a larger scale. Land availability, zoning and building regulations, and financing all pose challenges. But they're hopeful that the idea could take off if the right people get involved.
I just think that it's going to take the right entity to set aside a chunk of property and say, hey, we want to build these and do multiple at a time and save the money that way and get some people moved into these.
Until then, they'll move slowly, helping address housing shortages in rural Alaska, one mini home at a time. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Erin McKinstry.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Is an electric boat right for your marine business? There's an easy way to find out. More after this.
Have fish in the freezer? Have it on the table in minutes with Azmi's new Cook It Frozen and hundreds of other recipes at WildAlaskaSeafood.com.
No engine noise, no fuel slicks or emissions. Would an electric boat be suitable for your business? Newer battery banks and hybrid options make it ideal for several uses.
We're more focused on low-speed vessels, vessels that know where they're going to go every day and pretty much do the same routine. Some of the uses, you know, would be harbor port operations, tourism, recreation, or rental. And then, of course, fishing, especially mariculture, and, you know, trawlers plugging along at 2 to 3 knots.
Bob Varnas of Juneau runs Tongass Rain Electric Cruise LLC and has been doing gas to all electric or hybrid boat conversions since 2014. Now he's partnered with builders and suppliers to bring more vessels to Alaska.
And now we're pursuing identifying ideal areas of operation and then introducing electric boat alternatives to those operators.
It's newer and smaller high-energy lithium-ion batteries that make it possible. Studies show they can reduce vessel operating expenses by 75%. Electric boats also are submarine silent, Varnas says. That could remove the boat sound signatures that attract whales to longline hooks loaded with black cod.
Between an electric motor and some nice black cod traps, the whales wouldn't even know you're coming.
There is one hybrid diesel-electric fishing boat in Alaska, the Sunbeam, owned by Fabian Gruder of Sitka. Washington State also is converting its three largest ferries to hybrid drives to reduce greenhouse gas outputs. Varnas and his team aim to bring the earth-friendly option to more Alaska mariners.
I know it can be confusing and people may not know where to go, and that's our purpose, is to help and facilitate with those transitions.
Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon. It is time for our Island Messenger today. It is the 19th of April, 2021. The sun rose today at 6:51 a.m. It will set tonight at 9:29 p.m. The sun will rise again tomorrow at 6:48 a.m. That brings us to 14 hours and 44 minutes of daylight with a gain of 4 minutes and 52 seconds. The record high was 64 degrees in 1965, and the record low was 23 degrees in 1971 and 1972. Marmot Islands to Sitkanak for the marine weather. A gale warning today. Today, an east wind of 35 knots, seas to 15 feet. For tonight, an east wind of 30 knots, seas to 14 feet. For Tuesday, an east wind of 25 knots, seas to 9 feet. For the Shelikof Strait, a gale warning through tonight. Today, a northeast wind of 40 knots, seas to 16 feet. For tonight, a northeast wind of 40 knots, becoming east 25 knots after midnight. Seas to 16 feet, subsiding to 8 feet after midnight. And for the North Gulf Coast and Kodiak Island waters of Cook Inlet, a 992 millibar North Pacific low brings a front across the western Gulf through Tuesday morning. Low pressure lingers in the southwest Gulf through Wednesday morning.
Natives of Kodiak Incorporated is proposing to develop a new phased single-family residential subdivision near Spruce Cape. A virtual community meeting will be held on Wednesday, April 21st, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. A link to the meeting, as well as additional project information, is available at dowl.com/outreach. That's dowl.com/outreach. For more information, contact Alexa Green at agreene@dowl.com. agreene@dowl.com.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.